Good evening. May we all please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Amen. May we have roll call, please?
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll be taking roll call. Chair Hartwick?
Present.
Vice Chair Hurd?
Present.
Commissioner Castillo?
She's excused.
Excused.
Although she might show up.
Commissioner Griggs Murphy?
Here.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Here.
Commissioner Griffith?
She's excused.
She's excused.
And Commissioner Jungley?
She's excused but may show up.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve last meeting minutes?
Move to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Okay, carries unanimously. Old or unfinished business?
There is none.
Modifications to the agenda? None. And so now we're moving on to new business, item A.
New business, item A. Item A is recognition of the Oakland Housing Authority police explorers who participated in the police explorer competition hosted by the Stockton Police Department. I would like to invite up Captain Williams, who will shepherd the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Executive Director Johnson. Good evening, Chair Hartwig, Vice Chair Hurd, and fellow commissioners. James Williams, Oakland Housing Authority Police Department. I'm here tonight. This is one of the perks of my job, I think, is I get to talk about something that I'm passionate about, and that's our Police Explorer and Cadet Program. Our Cadet Explorer Program started back in 2010. For a few years, the Chief, myself, and some other officers wanted to do something to give back to the youth of our community and the youth that we serve. And we were struggling to find something, and we came up with the Cadet Explorer Program. And Luther Dupree, as you guys have met before, was very passionate about it, too. And he kind of got the ball rolling for us. And the program started, and it's been kind of up and down over the years. We've had several participants. We've had less participants as the years go on. We've had a few different coordinators of it. And all of them have done a fantastic job working with our youth, and we've been engaged throughout the years. But this, I would say, is one of the finer times in the program's history right now with our participation and with our mentorship from the officers. Just going to give you a real quick overview, and I'm going to turn it over to the real stars of this presentation. So the Cadet Explorer Program right now consists of 15 youth, all of whom live through various sites and are involved in various programs with the Oakland Housing Authority. Their parents and involved in different housing programs that we have, and we invite the youth to come participate and be a part of our program. Currently, right now, we have 12 explorers and 3 cadets, and the explorers consist of youth that are between the ages of 14 and 18 that are currently in high school. And to be involved in the program, they have to maintain a 2.0 GPA, and that's something that we check. We request report cards, and we also go to the school. We do site visits with the school. We talk to staff at the school, and we check on them. We do some mentoring on that portion of it. And then our cadets consist of youth that are between the ages of 18 and 21, and they have to be currently enrolled in college and have a minimum of 12 units. And as the Chief has said before, the goal of our program isn't to mentor youth into becoming police officers or becoming involved in law enforcement. The goal of our program is an educational program, and we hope that the youth use this as an opportunity just to become productive citizens and to be valuable members of our community here in Oakland. And so far, several of our previous cadets have taken advantage of that and have earned their degrees. And they've gone on to bigger and better things with their degrees, and not one of them have become involved as a sworn police officer, which is great. They've all just become productive members of society, which that's been our goal all along. Also involved in the program, we have our advisors, and tonight, the advisors with me tonight are Officer Chow, Officer Ramirez, and PSA Hawkins. And the advisors go through a training period with Boy Scouts of America. They have to go through online training, you know, the do's and don'ts and mentoring youth with running a youth program. And we have to update that training every 2 years. You have to continuously train, and our charter has to be renewed. And so we're constantly involved in the legal aspects of working with youth, and our adults are fully certified to participate. One of our coordinators, our newest coordinator for the program, and one of our mentors that I'm going to call up here in a minute is Chanry Kim. And Chanry Kim, like I said, is currently the coordinator for the program. However, Chanry Kim was one of our first cadets and one of our first explorers in the program. So her and her brother were some of the first people we had involved, and she's worked through the Explorer program. I mean, she's almost like a daughter to me. You know, I've seen her from high school all the way up into college. And so she became a cadet, worked in the department, and I'm happy to say that she's graduated on. She's actually gained employment with the Housing Authority. She's one of our police service aides. So she's a full-time employee now, and one of her responsibilities is to oversee the cadet program. And I will turn it over to her so she can continue on. So.
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Chanry Kim with OHAPD, Police Service Aid 3, assigned to communications, and a coordinator of the Explorer Post. I've been with the department since 2010 as one of the first police explorers and became a cadet in 2011, which in 2015, I was given the opportunity to become a full-time police service aide. During my 3 years of being a police service aide, I was very involved with the Explorer program, in which I was in the post as the associate advisor. I was then appointed as a full-time police explorer post coordinator in the end of 2017. It's been a huge privilege from being one of the first police explorers to be appointed as the coordinator. This program has given me many opportunities to grow into authority, and I'm extremely honored to be able to guide and mentor our explorers to do the same. This has been a very rewarding position. In 2018 till today's date, the explorers have committed and dedicated over 280 hours of community service to the authority and to the department. This also includes outside events hosted by the city and other local agencies. Currently, we have 15 explorers and cadets in the post, in which they all completed an intense youth academy at Richmond, and they also earned 3 college units. They attended 2 competitions during the summer when they competed amongst 25 agencies in the Central Valley competition. They placed in third place in the male individual obstacle course. At the second competition, all of their hard work paid off because they placed in 8 scenarios and took second place overall in the Stockton Explorer competition. Several agencies were highly impressed with our professionalism, and the explorers and cadets did an outstanding job representing our department. I want to take the time to express my appreciation to the Board of Commissioners, the authority, the executive office, OHAPD staff, and Chief Carol DePlessis for allowing us to participate in these events and for being our biggest supporters. With this said, I'm going to present the advisors that has been a huge asset and a great mentor to our young adults. First, we have Officer Philip Chow. Secondly, we have Officer Juan Ramirez. And lastly, we have Police Service Aide Cullis Hawkins. And now I'm happy to present each of our Explorer participants. First, we have Cadet Corporal Curtis Smith. Cadet Justin Nunez. Cadet Natalie Reese Palayo. Explorer Christina Vega. Explorer Felix Reese-Palayo. Explorer Richard Chin. Explorer Ishmael Bersenio. Explorer Johnny Brooks. Explorer Alejandro Negrete. Explorer Trishana Wilson. Explorer Aaron Williams. Explorer Jose Tesnado. Explorer Fran Acala. And lastly, Explorer David Thomas, who's not present. Explorers, you now can take your seats. I will now present Explorer Alejandro Negrete and Trishana Wilson to say a few words about their experiences in the program.
Oh, I'm nervous. Oh, y'all heard that? Okay. Okay. It's not too loud, right? Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Alejandro Negrete. I am 17 years old, and I am Explorer for the Oakland Housing Police Department. I was asked to do a speech, which I am very honored to do, about what this Explorer program has done for me. This was a very complex speech for me to do because there's a lot of things this Explorer program has actually done for me. Something that did come very easy to me was that this program has gave me a lot of experiences. This program has gave me new experiences from going to competitions to helping out in the community at block parties. Never in my life would I picture myself going to a competition and being able to stay at a hotel for more than a day, or winning 9 trophies. Or going to a block party and dressing up as a detective dog while little kids attack me. Although thanks to these block parties, I now realize that I can make a mean snow cone. Experiences like this had gave me new characteristics. Although the events that gave me new characteristics, the events that have changed me the most would be the good old academy. Although I hated every morning of it, it made me a better person. Thanks to the Oakland Housing Explorer Program, I had the privilege to attend the academy and grow as a person. Due to those experiences, I have the capability of a lot of things. I can now wake up early in the morning and actually know what I'm doing instead of being lost and confused in my own house, wondering what's in the fridge. Another important thing is that I have built my self-confidence, and I can now get yelled at and not feel panicked, thanks to my advisors. We would get yelled at, which would build us to be stronger individuals. In all seriousness, my favorite part and also my most influential part is our trainings every Friday. This has gave me the best experiences so far. There's nothing compared to what we go through here. And honestly, one of my favorite parts would be my first time fighting the red man. Yes, I know, not many people say that, but mine was special. Not because I had to do it in shorts and boots, but because I had my first actual jab to the face. But I thought, even though I was thinking, oh, this is really happening, okay, but I was getting punched. Finally, I saved the best for last. My favorite part of this whole thing is the tactical things we do. I feel very privileged to be in this to be here because not many people can say they have trained the way we train. For example, not many people can say they know how to stack up in an active shooter scenario and know what to do, but I can, and I am very happy for that. Plus, I like the guns. This Explorer program is a good program. Yeah, it showed me lots of things, and the best part is that it gave me a new family to turn back to when I need help. Thank you, everyone, for being here today, and thank you for this huge opportunity.
Hello, my name is Explore Wilson from the Oakland Housing Police Department. I've been a part of the Explore program since April. These past months have been challenging and most of all, rewarding. I've learned more about myself and I've found strength and resilience I didn't have before. This program for us is honestly more than just a program. We've created family bonds with one another. Thanks to the staff in the police department, they've devoted thank you to the staff. They've devoted their dedication and time into training us for the competition. We are extremely honored to have such strong support system in which we were able to go to a competition we've never competed at and bring back 8 trophies and place 2nd overall. On behalf of the Explore program, I want to give a special thank you to Mr. Eric Johnson, our executive director, for feeling the need to fund this program. Also, thank you to Captain Williams and Chief DePellis for your motivation. Lastly, we want to say thank you to our commissioners. Thank you. Thank you to our coordinator, PSA Kim, our advisors, Officer Chow and Officer Ramirez, and the entire OHA staff. Thank you. To the Board of Commissioners, we really appreciate you for having faith in the Oakland Housing Police Department to run such a strong beneficial program. This program has made a great impact in all of our lives. Thank you everyone again for the opportunity.
Hello, Commissioners. Thank you for your time and thank you for the opportunities. Do you have any questions?
No, we thank you. Really a wonderful job. I know that I for sure, and I'm sure everybody else can feel the enthusiasm, because it's when you can feel something, that's when you know it's working.
Thank you.
So thanks to all of you for a really cool, something really fantastic.
Yeah. Commissioners, will you join us for a photo?
Sure. Yeah, maybe we should stand up here. Would that be easier? Because there's a lot of people. Do you want us to come down? Okay.
Down or up? Up or down? Up or down?
We will come down.
We will come.
Thank you.
It is. It's great.
Thank you all. We're very proud.
Okay, excellent. So now we are now ready to go to item B under new business.
Item B is consideration of a resolution approving an increase of up to $1.8 million in construction and permanent financing and authorizing the negotiation and execution of documents related to the acquisition, leasing, financing, and development of the Empyrean Towers Rehabilitation with Harrison Menlo Preservation LP. And I will turn it over to the head of our Office of Real Estate Development, Dave Cadeau, who will do a brief presentation.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Dave Cadeau, Senior Director of Real Estate Development. As you know, back in 2016, this commission awarded $5 million in financing for the rehabilitation of the Empyrean Towers. Subsequently, as the project has gone on, a few conditions have caused cost overruns that need to be addressed by the sponsor. Primarily, the cost of construction has gone up substantially over the last couple of years, and certain elements of the scope were particularly challenging to budget for, such as structural improvements in a building that had not been opened up yet, and things of that nature. So they had a gap of approximately $8 million a couple of months ago. And they've done a great job of paring down scope, finding alternative scope that saved them quite a bit of money. And now the gap stands at roughly $1.8 million, and we're here today to ask you for authorization to lend an additional $1.8 million so that we can get across the finish line and meet our deadline to place this project under construction by January. I believe that this project has a great deal of public purpose. It serves Oakland's most vulnerable residents, and it preserves an existing resource here downtown. As you can see, all the changes going on around us is potentially impacting the ability of low-income residents to stay in this neighborhood. So we feel very strongly that this recommendation should be adopted. I am happy to answer any specific questions that you have. We also have a representative from the sponsor here with us today if you have any specific questions for her.
So you did say that $1.8 million, right? But if they leverage other funds, maybe from A1 or from some, mm-hmm. it might go down?
No, we're intending to lend that $1.8 million, which gets us basically to the skinniest possible scope of work that the project can safely house residents using. They are going after other sources of funding, but that would be to restore other items of scope that they've cut out already. So we can get across the finish line with 1.8, but we're hoping that we have a little more, you know, to play with so that the project can be a little happier at the end of it.
You go. You'll wait for us. Thank you so much. I just have some clarification questions.
Absolutely.
The $5 million that we set aside from this project, is this on top of or under?
This is in addition to the $5 million. So if this request is approved, the total financial contribution from this agency to this project will be $6.8 million.
And in February we actually increased it 1.4.
I think in February we increased the pre-development loan amount, so it was the chunk of the $5 million that we had initially awarded that could be expended before we closed construction.
Yeah, and that's all included in the 6.8. So when 6. We do the pre-development stuff comes out of the total allotment. It's just advanced earlier.
Believe me, I'm just asking clarifying questions.
Oh, no, that's fine. Absolutely.
We now own the land under the building. Is that correct?
I don't think we've closed on that transaction yet, but we will. We will when they close the rest of their financing. So part of the $6.8 million will be used to purchase the land, which we will then lease back to the partnership who will own the project, and that's a kind of a way of securing affordability over the long term.
Yeah, I really, really love that part. Mm-hmm. So within the $6.8 million comes the funding to secure and acquire the land under the mm-hmm. building.
That's correct. We're acquiring the land for the appraised value, which unfortunately I don't have to have off the top
it's
of my
2
head.
$2.7
million. Thank you. And the balance will go to fund other capital improvements.
Okay, perfect. So there's a note in here on page one that says a portion of the funding set aside for year 15 transitions will be moved to cover the increased budget. Can you tell me what the year 15 transitions is?
Actually, Bridget, would you mind hopping up here? I'm going to ask Bridget Galka to come up. She's got more project-specific information.
We all have that question.
What is that?
Section 8 transition reserve or something else.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'm Bridget Galka. I'm the Assistant Director of the Office of Real Estate Development. The 18-19 budget. The 18-19, is that better? Budget had $3 million for year 15 transitions, and that would be for Chestnut Linden when the authority purchases the project, or the LP interest and Mandela Gateway. So we're not going to be needing that $3 million for that purpose, and so we're going to move that amount that's in the budget already to this line.
I just want to be clear what you just said. We're not going to be needing it versus when we're that's different than what I'm thinking. So when we move it over, it's because that's where we have it and it's not obligated to another project, and so let's pull it from there. Is
correct
that
correct.
Thank you.
Yes, specifically we were able to buy out Chestnut Linden for much lower than our projected amount, so we were able to use that savings.
Yeah. Yes. Very good. Yes. Cool. Another question I have is on page 3 or 4. It looks like in order to reduce the amount that they needed, did they really need to sacrifice adding kitchens to 30 apartments at Harrison Hotel? Was that one of the sacrifices?
Unfortunately, it was. It is. It is. But, you know, we had to do, or they had to do what they had to do to get under, you know, under budget. I believe that's among the things, the first things that would be added back in should they be successful in the county funding round. And, you know, they serve a population that is pretty well aligned with the A1 requirements, so we're hopeful that they can bring those funds in. But, yes, that was one of the difficult decisions they had to make.
And it leads me to kind of ask for clarification. In the plans for doing both buildings at once, the Harrison and the Imperium, it looks like the Harrison is the stepchild. You know what I'm saying? It's like we need to do this first versus the Harrison Hotel. Can you explain what the plans are for both? Because they needed to bring them both up, mm-hmm. right? We were upgrading both. For some reason, we had to combine both buildings and do them both at the same time. Yet the Harrison House is not as much as a priority as I feel like the Imperium. I was wondering if you could clarify that.
Well, part of it is we're not part, the Harrison Hotel, we're not part of that.
We're not part
we're
of
We're part of the Imperium.
There's shelter plus care vouchers at the Hotel.
We're not part of the redevelopment and the restructure. So it seems like it from our perspective. It doesn't seem like it, I think, from RCD's perspective. And the Harrison Hotel is 100% assisted by this agency at this point. So they've already...
100%
yep.
100% assisted by this agency?
Yeah, through both, through a couple of programs.
All right. But they're not going to get kitchens.
They're not, unless they can find other funding to do that.
All right. Well, let's see if we can maybe make that happen over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
I've been through there, so I know how badly it needs some help. Yeah. I think that was it for me. As always, preserving the few affordable housing units that we have left is God's work, and it's an uphill climb, and I'm so appreciative of this project. Thank you so much for sticking in it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the new renovations at the Imperium.
Thank you.
Oh,
Hopefully it won't cost us any more money. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Lynette.
Following Commissioner Castillo's questions about the kitchen, I'm just wondering, are there common kitchens already at the Harrison that tenants can use if they don't have individual kitchens?
So we'd like to call up the sponsor representative at this time.
If you can introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Jessica with Resources for Community Development. We are a Berkeley-based nonprofit who's the sponsor of the project. We own Harrison and Imperial now as well, actually. Harrison does have community kitchens. It has, on the ground floor, has full kitchen facilities. So those will remain. And we are applying for funding to add kitchens to the units. You know, if it comes through, we will run with that. It's just a matter of budget. Right, more. Yeah.
All right, great.
Well, I think I agree that this is an important project, and I'm ready to make a motion for approval unless there are more questions.
You have a question? Okay. Yeah. Commissioner Hurd has some questions.
So, again, thank you. I'm very appreciative of the project also. Coming out of homelessness, I went into an SRO, and I didn't have a kitchen. And so I saw the need for kitchens. So in reading this, I was moved and grateful that's going to happen. So I have a couple of questions. Page 2, at the very top, it says the Imperium had a history of poor management and code violations. I wanted to know how that affected the tenants. And I want to know, it says that RCD is working with existing tenants to transition them into subsidized rehab unit on-site, but existing residents will need to be temporarily relocated. How is that process going to work?
So there are about 45 people living at Empyrean right now. Mm-hmm. Empyrean's an SRO right now. And so for that property, we are making them full studios and a few one-bedrooms. So those are going to have kitchens. They're going to have their own bathrooms. And that's because that property needs a full structural rehab anyway. Okay. So we're opening up everything. And so we're able to kind of leverage this opportunity to create more full units there. So the 45 folks living there, I mean, it's has been not a great place to live. It's definitely, they've lived through a lot.
Yes.
They haven't had seven stories. The elevator has been broken, you know, for years before we acquired the property. And it's actually in part due to the pre-development funding coming from the housing authorities under construction right now. And so that work should be complete within the next month. So finally, there'll be a functioning elevator there.
Okay.
During construction, we are still weighing kind of what is going to be the best thing for the residents in terms of their life. During about 8 months when we're going to be working in the apartments there. Mm-hmm. The two options are to move people to do kind of a split the building in half, do construction here, move everyone to this side, then move everyone back and do this side. The other option is to move everyone off-site to hotels for about 8 months and then move them back.
For 8 months?
About 8 months is going to be the period of time that we're going to be working on the apartments. Yeah. We are still figuring kind of what are the pros and cons and costs and benefits of those two options. You know, there's not a perfect solution either way. But either way, we are currently, you know, everyone who's going to continue living there has to be low income.
Okay.
And we're finishing up the income certifications. Everyone's documenting their income. And so far, all but one person qualifies. You know, their income is under 60% of the area median income, so they'll continue to live there permanently. It's just a matter of what happens temporarily during the major construction.
Okay, and then have you met with the residents and gone over this with them?
Yes, we've had about four community meetings with residents at Empyrean. We'll have another one in November.
Four meetings. Okay, two more questions. Let's see, page... Okay, page 3. It says the authority's residual receipt loan will be repaid with a share of 50% of the residual receipts on a prorated basis. Can you explain that?
Sure, absolutely. So there are multiple lenders who will be giving loans to the projects. I believe potentially city, county, housing authority, and state will all be involved. And so when it comes time to divide up the excess cash flow between those lenders, the lenders will each get their share based on, you know, whatever proportion of the total financing they provide. Okay. So if the housing authority provides 10% of the soft financing, they'll get 10% of the cash flow.
Okay, understood. Last question. Mm-hmm. Same page at the bottom. It says, if the partnership meets all the terms and conditions outlined in the ACA, and the authority increases its funding commitment by $1.8 million, the authority will execute the following agreement. So do you foresee any problems there?
No, I do not.
You don't?
Assuming that we get authorization this evening, I think we should be pretty good to go.
Okay, great. So, again, in closing, someone who was once homeless came out homeless thanks to Oakland Housing Authority putting me in an SRO. Now it's grateful living in an SRO without a kitchen, and I dealt with a kitchen, but you know what I made my kitchen? My bathroom. And so I'm really grateful that this is going to happen for our residents in this building, and I look forward to seeing its completion. And so I move to approve.
Can I have one more comment?
Yes, you may.
I want to tell you that, and I'm sure you know this, we're really good at finding a way to move our residents from one apartment to the other, mm-hmm. to reduce the impact on their lives.
Yes.
And I'm hoping that you reach out to us. I'm hoping for some expertise on how to do that.
Yes.
You could spend more time in the development, mm-hmm. but truthfully, you actually, it benefits you with residents who appreciate not being moved out to a motel. It seems a little not as okay as moving them from one apartment to the other, and I'm hoping you reach out to us so that you could see how we do it, because I think we're pretty good at doing it.
Yes,
and it takes us longer, but I believe we do it the right way.
Thank you,
if you would, yeah. If the director agrees, I hope
so.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have one. So this is essentially a residual receipts loan.
Correct.
Is that what it is? So that means that there's no real, there's no formal payback on it. It's simply if there is excess cash flow over break even, it gets divided up among the lenders. Is that how this works?
That's correct. And, you know, in a SRO project at extremely low incomes, there's typically not a lot of cash flow to go around.
Right.
If there was, they wouldn't be talking to me. They'd be talking to Bank of America. So,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
I would not anticipate that we're going to get a ton of money back on this, frankly. But, you know, the public purpose is our payback for all intents.
Well, how does that play out at the end of the cycle?
Mm-hmm.
So there's some period of life, right, for this round?
Well, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So this loan would be 55 years. And at the end of 55 years, we'd have to evaluate what the expected useful life of the building is. And typically, I think the intent would be to allow an extension of the term. You know, I just don't think the value is going to be there to have a payback of the soft loans at the end of the project mm-hmm. lifespan. And
so this is essentially an investment then, really.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Good clarification.
Yes,
very
good. Thank you for asking that.
All right, cool.
So I did move to approve.
We have a motion. Okay. Do we have a second?
I second.
Okay. All those in favor, aye.
All in favor.
Aye.
Any
aye.
Opposed? Aye. Any abstentions? Nope. Carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
We're building. Okay. So now now we're ready for our presentation and training on affordable housing development.
Good evening. This was put on the agenda at the request of Ann Griffin, who couldn't be here tonight, but we'll get her the training. But she wanted to do an overview through the chair. She had asked if we could put it on the agenda, and Mr. Cadu has prepared some slides that are of interest. It came about really as an OPI meeting as we were talking about the development process, and she thought everybody, including myself, could use a refresher. So we're going to walk through some slides and here to answer any questions. So we understand things like the year five that you were asking, what that means for each deal, you know, it's different. But
thank you.
So I'll turn it over to Mr. Cadu.
Sure, thank you very much. And I will say that this is going to be a lengthy presentation. I will endeavor to make it as painless as possible, though given the subject matter, that might not be possible. If there are any questions that come up during the presentation, feel free to break in and stop me at any time. I think that would be the best way to approach it. So we'll try to keep it on track that way. So this is a general training about the low-income housing tax credit program and some additional associated issues related to privately financed projects. Typically in the past, we've seen this as sort of a mixed finance deal. When we developed, say, Lion Creek, we had tax credits come into those deals, but also had public housing units involved. Because of the changing nature of the market and the changing nature of affordable housing, we're not likely to continue including public housing units in any of these deals, but, you know, we are going to continue to try to expand the number of units in our portfolio by doing these tax credit deals. So the short story on this is, the tax credit program was created through the Tax Reform Act of 1986. There are a number of incentives in that act that were for affordable housing, but low-income housing tax credits were the big one, and it to this day remains the biggest way that affordable housing is financed in this country. It's a program that's ultimately overseen by the IRS, and the IRS then gives the authority to issue tax credits to various state bodies, and it's done on a per capita basis. So in 2018, state of California got $2.40 of annual federal tax credit authority per capita. The state allocating agencies then adopt a qualified allocation plan, which must be approved by the IRS, outlining the rules and regulations for how the program is administered. So if you went up and tried to do development in Oregon or Washington, you would see a slightly different set of regulations based on what the state requires. The allocating agency in California is TCAC, California Tax Credit Allocation Committee. It's a division of the Treasurer's Office, and the gist of it is that developers apply to TCAC for credits, and, you know, TCAC makes the decisions on allocations. TCAC also plays the role of the monitoring agency that they measure compliance over the 55-year compliance period for each of these projects. When a developer gets an allocation of tax credits, they typically will then turn and sell the tax credits to investors. It's possible that a for-profit developer could simply keep the credits and use that for their own purposes, but it never works out that way. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a deal like that. There are some historical instances where it happened back in the 1980s, but that's just not the way the industry is working anymore. The tax credits that the developers sell to the investors are allocated over a 10-year period, and the investors are allowed to reduce their taxes on a dollar-for-dollar basis for each dollar of credits they get. So it's a little different than a deduction that you would get on your income taxes, right, for your personal uses. It doesn't offset a dollar of income. It offsets an actual dollar of tax, so it's a pretty powerful incentive for the investors. The investors, in turn, will give equity to the developers to develop the project. And so, you know, typically in a market rate development, the rule of thumb is that you would have 80% debt, 20% equity when you build an apartment building. That 20% is what would have to be filled by the investor. In this case, because we have affordable housing, our rents are much lower, therefore our income is much lower, and we can borrow much less in the debt market, we typically need a much larger share to come from equity, and that's where the tax credit program comes in. So just generally speaking, oh, yes, absolutely.
Can you tell me what 240 per capita is? That's how far you've got to go for me.
Oh, no, that's fine. And feel free to interrupt at any time. So that means that every year the IRS allows the state of California to have $2.40 of tax credits for every person who lives in the state of California.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's, my math is not very good, but it's around $60 million a year, something like that.
$60 million. Yeah. Wow, so the census has just got really important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That where they do the count?
For any number of reasons, but yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when it started out, the program only allocated about $1.25 per person. So over time, and especially under the Obama administration, the program has aggressively expanded in recognition of need for affordable housing as well as the effectiveness of the housing tax credit as a tool.
Wow, thank you.
Sure. So just briefly, there are two types of tax credits that the state of California is allowed to allocate through this program. The first is referred to as the 9% tax credit, and this is a very highly competitive tax credit competition. Typically, the 9% rounds are oversubscribed by a factor of 4 or 5 to 1, and that doesn't even account for all the projects that are never even taken forward because the developers know they have no prayer of getting funded. So, you know, the demand for this would be limitless if it were allowed to be limitless, but the IRS has a cap on it, so the competition is still very, very fierce. There's a second type of tax credit, and this is the type of tax credit that, for the foreseeable future, the Housing Authority and its affiliates will use. It's a 4% tax credit, and this is a tax credit that in itself is not competitive. It's awarded to any project that wants it under the condition that that project has received an allocation from TCAC's sister agency, the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee, or CDLAC. The project has received an allocation of tax-exempt bonds. Tax-exempt bonds are currently also not competitive, but if demand raises high enough, the IRS will put a cap on how many projects can be funded through this program, and it will become competitive as well.
What are the 9% credits currently selling for? Because I know that it's reduced because of the tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so currently the pricing we typically see on tax credits in the city of Oakland is going to be somewhere between 90 cents and a dollar. Okay. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, prior to the last presidential election, prior to tax reform, I worked on projects where the pricing was as high as $1.21 per credit. So you can see that's the type of thing that can take a pretty substantial bite out of a project's budget. In fact, it's one of the reasons why we've asked you today for more funding for the Imperium, because they were unable to get as much equity as they had originally anticipated prior to tax reform. Excuse me. So the amount of credits that any particular project will receive, it's going to vary project by project, and it will depend on several different factors. The two big ones are the cost of the project itself. So they use something called eligible basis to determine the amount of tax credits that are allocated, and we'll get into it a little bit later, but eligible basis is basically the construction cost and construction-related cost for any given project. The other factor is the percentage of the project that is going to be used for affordable housing. So you typically see projects go in as 100% affordable, so you get all the tax credits that you're eligible for. But if a project was, for instance, 50% affordable and 50% market rate, it would only get half of the allocation that it otherwise would be eligible to get. Tax credit equity can provide up to, theoretically, provide up to 70% of the total development costs for a 9% deal, and that's specifically how the deal was structured. It was intended to provide 70% of the equity. Because of changes to the program, because of the challenges of working in the state of California, typically TCAC will award projects that only get 40 to 50% of their total development costs from the tax credit program in the 9% rounds. For a 4% deal, those numbers drop to the intention of funding 30%, the reality of funding roughly 20%. So these projects are all owned by limited partnerships. That's a feature that's a requirement of the tax code. The investor will typically be the limited partner and will receive credits over a 10-year tax credit delivery period. But the investor will typically stay in for 15 years because that's what they call the initial compliance period, and that's where they have liability if we don't make good on our promise to keep the project affordable or if other issues come up that threaten the delivery of the tax credits. Beyond that, the total affordability period that's recorded against the property and is the responsibility of the owner is 55 years. In theory, it could be as low as 30, but because of the way the competition is structured, it is basically impossible to receive an award if you don't agree to go to a full 55. Are there any questions about that introductory part at this point?
Yeah, I just have one, which you might get to, but I'm just wondering why we're assuming that we're not going to be eligible for the 9% credits.
Okay. I don't actually address that in this presentation. Primarily, at this point, it's because we don't meet the criteria for developers who are allowed to compete for those credits. So one of the criteria that TCAC uses on the scoring is an experience metric. And you need to have, I think it's 3 projects over the last 5 years to compete. And so we can potentially get there if we do enough 4% deals, which don't carry that requirement. But as of right now, we would not score points in that category, and you must score full points to be funded.
So no, why are we not scoring points in that category? Because is it because our partners have taken the lead in this?
So that's correct.
They're the ones that have the experience?
Yes, sir.
And the fact that we're helping them, we can't leverage off of that?
That's correct. Yeah, we need to be the primary sponsor, the primary developer, and we have not played that role since Tessa Faranga, I believe.
I see. Okay, yeah. Cool. Thank you.
It's my intention to get us to the point where we can compete, but right now we can't.
Yes.
Yeah, I forgot to ask this question on page 5. You said that tax-exempt bonds currently non-competitive, and you talked about the IRS putting a cap.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
Sure, absolutely. So the cap is actually already in place. Just like with the tax credit program, the tax-exempt bond credit or the tax-exempt bond program has a per capita per person allocation that each state receives to be able to issue tax-exempt bonds. The reality of the situation for the last decade or so has been that the state has received more cap room than it has received projects applying for the bonds, so it's never run into an issue where it's become competitive. They've been able to fund everybody, so they don't worry too much about what the scoring looks like.
Okay.
However, with all the local and state funding that's coming online, mm-hmm. we're likely to see a lot more activity in the 4% bond market, which is a great thing, but it also means that those funds will likely become competitive in the near future.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'll go into a little more depth in the partnership. So the very, very basic concept, as noted before, is that you partner with an investor who joins your partnership. You are allocated tax credits, and the investor purchases those credits as well as losses related to depreciation and other tax benefits. In exchange for equity that's used to develop the projects. And as noted, in Oakland right now, we're looking at about 90 cents to a dollar for each dollar of credits.
Yes.
I've seen it as low as 75. That would be back around 2008, 2009 during the recession when there was simply no demand for tax credits because nobody was making any money. And I've seen it as high as $1.21 plus at the very height of the market a couple years ago.
Can you? I really believe that that's almost the important piece that I'm trying to understand. Say that again just a little bit more slower. That
sure.
They purchase tax credits for equity? Or
right. Yeah, so the gist of it is, say the Housing Authority were to develop one of these properties. The Housing Authority would go to the Tax Credit Allocation Committee and apply for tax credits. We get an award, which means if we actually built the building, the IRS would give us tax credits. But as a public agency, we don't pay taxes.
Have any
right.
tax burden.
Right. So we can't use the credits ourselves. And so instead, we would go out and find an investor who's willing to buy the credits from us.
Uh-huh.
But it's not as simple as buying the credits, they actually have to be a participant in the partnership to access the tax benefits.
Wow.
So there's been a move to try and change that so that we could simply sell them as certificates to an investor, but that's not happened and it doesn't have any serious traction. So basically it means we're joined at the hip with the investor for 15 years because they need that to actually get the benefit for the money they're providing.
But there are times when they can apply for the tax credit directly, right?
Well, investors typically aren't developers.
Investors. Yeah. And that's the difference, investors and developers.
Right, yeah. And so I'll get a little more into the roles here. But typically an investor is going to be a bank or some other institution that has no desire to own, operate, or develop affordable housing. They just want their tax liability sheltered. So it's basically a way for them to purchase the ability to pay fewer taxes. It's what happens when you let the IRS design your affordable housing program, unfortunately, but it's what we're stuck with. To get a little deeper into what this looks like, we've got yet another chart here. As noted before, the owner of these deals are always partnerships. And the two component partners of those partnerships are going to be the limited partner, who's the investor. That can either be a bank operating as a direct investor or what we call a syndicator, which is a group that puts together portfolios of investors who then invest in your project. A limited partner typically owns 99.99% of the deal on paper. As we'll see in future slides, that doesn't mean they have 99.99% of the responsibilities, but the more of the project they own, the bigger share of the tax credits and the tax benefits they can get. So typically we try to push that as far to the edge as we can, and that usually means 99.99%. The general partner typically does all the work and takes all the responsibility is going to be an affiliate of the Oakland Housing Authority. And so functionally the way we're going to structure this is we will have one of our nonprofit entities, probably Ramp Housing Inc., which is newly formed, or OPI, be the sole member of an LLC, limited liability corporation, that will then be the general partner of the partnership. And we structure it that way to provide as much insulation between the housing authority and the partnership and all the risks and liabilities that the partnership is involved with as possible. So it gets to be a bit of a maze, but you know, generally speaking, we own 0.01% of the project. That's right. we talk a little bit about the sponsor or the developer. That doesn't need to be the exact same entity as the general partner. And in fact, when we talk about who the sponsor of the deal is or the developer of the deal is, it's probably going to be Ramp Housing Inc. for most of the projects we have in the foreseeable future. So to break down what the general partners and limited partners are typically responsible for, we've got this kind of side-by-side chart. So as noted, general partner is typically 0.01% of the partnership. Limited partner is 99.99%. The general partner will manage the day-to-day operations of the property, and that doesn't just mean property management, but it means also kind of higher-level asset management functions. The general partner is responsible for getting welfare tax exemptions, for instance, and maintaining the corporate status of the partnership and all the things that, you know, actually require day-to-day work. The limited partner typically has no direct management of the partnership. They will have rules established in the partnership agreement that we have to follow, but it's intentionally structured such that the limited partner is not in the driver's seat. General partner can be a nonprofit corporation or nonprofit-controlled limited liability corporation. I think, in theory, the sponsor could also be a for-profit, but a for-profit cannot qualify for the welfare tax exemption, so you very rarely see that. Limited partner is going to be either a single corporate investor, and in most cases that would mean a bank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank. In some cases, there are multi-investor syndicators that we work with. A lot of times those syndicators are nonprofits chartered specifically to broker tax credit investments from corporations that don't want to get in directly. So, for instance, at Tessa Farango, we use a group called the National Equity Fund. They're a nonprofit syndicator. All they do is syndicate tax credits on behalf of institutional investors such as banks, insurance companies, tech companies have been getting into the game. But none of those groups really want to be directly involved. So they're two or three layers of partnerships on this side. They get to access the tax benefits, but they're miles away from the actual operations of the property.
Now, what happens at the end of the 15-year period for the limited partners, the investment partners?
Yeah, so I've got a few slides on that a little later on. But you know, generally speaking, they exit the property by selling their interest. But I'll get into some gory details on that in a minute.
So, what was the name of that? Excuse me, what was the name? You said National Housing what?
National Equity Fund, NEF.
Yeah,
I think they worked with us on Tessa Farango. There are a few other entities that do that type of thing. Enterprise Community Foundation has a syndication arm. They do a lot of other community development type things, but syndication is one of their big things. So, right, you know, there are a number of these entities out there.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the general partner basically is liable for everything that goes wrong with the partnership. Usually they're protected a little bit by, you know, the way we structure guarantee obligations or the fact that permanent debt is typically not recourse to the borrower. So in other words, it would be secured by deeds of trust on the property rather than secured by a personal guarantee of the general partner. The limited partner, you know, the golden rule is he who has the gold makes the rules. So the limited partner rarely has any liability whatsoever. It's limited to their equity investment, but generally speaking, the responsibility lies on the general partner. General partner or general partner affiliate is the developer of the project. The limited partner is not a developer and does not want to be a developer. General partner will receive certain fees for services. The big one is the developer fee, which we talk about. It can be several million dollars in some cases. There are other fees that we get, such as the partnership management fee, which is an annual ongoing fee that's given to us for providing the service of managing the partnership and filing the tax documents and doing all those things. The syndicator typically would get fees, but they would get fees from their investors and not from the project. So if you had multiple investors investing through a syndicator, you know, we would not see that. It would just be priced into what they're willing to pay for the credits. And there's also generally an investor asset management fee or investor services fee. It's usually not much, $4,000 or $5,000 a year, but that's just their compliance department keeping the lights on.
Somebody say something.
Okay. and so finally, you know, when it comes to cash flow, we'll get into this a little bit later. The general partner will generally try to get as much of that as possible, and the limited partner is usually not particularly interested in cash flow. If it turns out that there's an unusually large amount of cash flow, they might become interested. So it's pretty important that we structure the deal such to protect our claims to that. The limited partner will require certain guarantees to be made by the general partner and affiliate of the general partner to secure their investment. And we will go into that in greater detail a little later on as well. Go into it right now. So there are three general categories of guarantees that we would be required to make as part of, you know, our securing an investment in these projects. The big one is the operating deficit guarantee. This is an ongoing guarantee that basically says if for whatever reason our cash flow is not sufficient to pay our debt or our operating expenses, we will kick in the rest to make sure we can keep the lights on and not go into default in our mortgage. It's usually capped by a certain amount, so it can be equal to the developer fee or equal to some other number, which would be several million dollars in aggregate. They're usually time limited, so if we prove that we can run the property without having an issue for 5 years, the guarantee obligation goes away, which is often a very good event for us. And we may be able to use operating reserves that we fund to step in front of this obligation to pay this guarantee. But a lot of times investors will force you to both fund an operating deficit guarantee as well as an operating reserve as well as put up an operating deficit guarantee, and they will not allow you to use the reserves until you have exhausted your guarantee. So it's not a great situation for us, but it is often what the industry requires.
So that's like an escrow kind of thing.
That's correct. Yeah. So the reserves would be held by the partnership and would basically just have to sit there for 15 years for most cases. But
so, to the chair, can I ask? So let me just, you might are going to say this later on, but I just wanted to go back that the LP is only interested in tax benefits, yet they own 99% of the property.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That is.
So how does that work for them financially, that that is such a good deal for them?
So there are a number of motivating factors for investors, and, you know, the first is a basic financial return. So they get the tax credits, which are a one-to-one thing, right? For every dollar of tax credits they get to not pay a dollar of taxes. So the value of that is fairly easy to figure out. But in addition to that, they get to claim 99.99% of the depreciation that's taken off of a property. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about a $20 million building that depreciates over 40 years, that means they get $500,000 a year to deduct from their taxes.
On top of?
That's correct. Yeah, on top of the tax credits. So
set it up for me, mm-hmm. dollar-wise. So we just bought a building for $100, and I used tax credits to mm-hmm. buy that building for $100.
Right.
So I can deduct $100 from my taxes dollar for dollar.
That's correct. Yeah. So, well, if you got $100
we're talking about millions of dollars, but yeah. I need
sure, to yeah. So if you got $100 of tax credits, mm-hmm. you would be able to deduct $100. That's
tax
right.
Credit.
Yeah.
And then you're saying it depreciates like $100. I get more to be able to. The depreciation piece, how does that work?
That's right. So when a for-profit corporation owns a piece of real estate, the IRS says that depending on what tax schedule you're using, it's say you get to depreciate the value of that building over 27 and a half years.
Oh, the value of
right.
the building.
Yeah. So basically what it says is you build a building for some amount of money, and every year it gets a little older. You know, it's useful life, you're getting closer to the end, and therefore, from a tax perspective, it's not worth as much as it used to be. So you get to actually deduct whatever you lose in depreciation, which is like purely a paper thing. It doesn't mean you're actually losing money, but you get to deduct part of the value of the building
wow.
every year.
That's
and
amazing.
So when the limited partner is in the deal, they get to take 99.99% of the depreciation. For buildings that are worth tens of millions of dollars,
yeah.
that can be substantial. Yeah.
Okay.
And in addition to that, a lot of banks also have obligations under the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a Carter-era piece of legislation that requires banks to invest in low-income communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so by virtue of buying into a low-income housing tax credit deal, Bank of America can say, hey, we're lending in low-income neighborhoods.
True.
And they can be in compliance with that act. It's kind of toothless, but banks still try to stay in compliance.
Of course. And the contracts are so tight that they're not able just to come in and sell the property and liquidate, right?
That's correct, yeah. There are very strong restrictions on how the property can be disposed of. The general partner has to approve, so on and so forth. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow, this is amazing. Thank you for sharing this.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Do the limited liability partners get to deduct interest as well?
They do, okay. And operating loss
wow.
and all those things.
Yeah.
So,
it's such a sweet deal for them.
As you might imagine, for a large tax credit building that doesn't produce much income, that can be substantial as well. And they get to deduct soft loan interest. So these loans that we're making with no expectation of repayment, they still get to take the interest and deduct them from the taxes.
Wait a minute. You mean there's actually no cash is transferred, but they get to take the interest?
Well, no. So if we loan $10 million for a building to be built, for an affordable housing development to be built, you know, in theory, we could get paid back at any time, and the note will be drafted that we could get paid back after our 55 years comes up. But the expectation is typically that we're not going to get paid back. We don't plan to get paid back in 55 years because the affordability restrictions are worth it to us to basically limit the amount that they repay. But it's still a real loan. It still accrues real interest at 3% a year or whatever, and the investor gets to walk away with the deductions from that interest that accrues on those loans. So it's not a real loan, but it's real interest for their tax purposes.
So it's sort of like depreciation, then. It's another because that's a non-cash
Absolutely.
Expense, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, cool for the investors, at least.
Well, yeah. Can you, so what leeway is there in adjusting that rate? I mean, supposing the rate on this loan we're making here, we said, that'll just be 8%.
Right.
I mean, that would really get the investors excited.
Well, yeah, but you have to guard against having them get too many deductions. If the deductions outpace the actual equity they put into the project, when they sell it at year 15, they have an exit tax liability.
Oh, I see.
And that can be pretty substantial. So
I see. Okay.
We'll touch on that a little later. We won't get too deep into it. But, yeah, there's always a balancing act trying to give them enough but not too much, you know.
Yeah, one question. So you said that if they're lending in low-income communities, did you say banks lending, or who was that?
Well, yeah, so the Community Reinvestment Act, I think, was put in place in 1978. It was in response largely to redlining and other issues that had come up over the history of American banking, where banks were simply not doing business in certain communities. And so as a response to that, Congress said, okay, no, you absolutely have to do business in these communities or else we'll give you a penalty of some sort. The penalties aren't great, but banks try to stay in compliance anyway. And so, you know, a lending in certain neighborhoods qualifies, so does investment. So if they invest equity in a low-income housing tax credit deal in a low-income neighborhood, it satisfies that obligation. And so typically where they're most motivated to do business is going to be somewhere like Oakland, where they're doing a lot of really high-dollar business in nice neighborhoods, but there's also a substantial low-income population. So this is a really sweet spot for them to get in for CRA purposes.
Okay, like East Oakland.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. One more question. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to find out who's doing it?
Who's
doing it? In low-income communities?
Yes, and I can't remember which regulatory agency monitors it, but Community Reinvestment Act reporting is publicly available, and it's online. And you'll be very disappointed to learn that basically everybody is in compliance when we kind of know that's not the case.
Yes.
I can't imagine that the current administration is too eager to enforce the CRA, so it's probably not happening very much, but you can go online and you can typically...
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
So going back to guarantees, the second major guarantee is going to be a completion guarantee, and that's basically during the course of construction, if there's a cost overrun or some other issue, the sponsor is obligated to provide funds to finish the deal. It can be a very intense obligation, but it burns off once the building is done, so it's a short-lived guarantee. And finally, there's an ongoing tax credit compliance guarantee, which basically means if we somehow rent to the household that is over income and lose tax credits, we're on the hook to make the investor whole for the tax credits they lose. I've never actually seen any of these three guarantees called on in a deal in my 15 years in this business. It doesn't mean that they're not risks, but we typically do a pretty good job of, you know, finishing the deal and operating them as intended. So that mitigates our risk somewhat. So basic affordability that's tied to the program. Federal government says we need to either provide 20% of units at 50% of median income or 40% at 60. Functionally, we almost always choose 40 at 60. Those are augmented by the state guidelines, and for 9% credits, those guidelines indicate that you need to have an average affordability in the property of 50% AMI or below, and you need to have at least 10% of the units under 30% AMI. And so in order to compete, you have to score maximum points on this, so that's pretty much what we're obligated to do.
But how does our high rents right now affect this?
I mean,
we're looking at extraordinary, well, average medium income, that's different than the high rents that we have going on. But we still have, well, wait, it does work because as people come in to rent the apartments that they can, those incomes are higher than normal, and so the average medium incomes are being raised because of that, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So how does that affect the building's affordability?
Yeah, so
general.
I'll go through how the rents are set here in a minute, but generally speaking, you know, I mean, if the We have a problem in the Bay Area where the average or the area median income is going up very rapidly because, you know, the area is gentrifying. And, you know, actually for the lower income residents, their incomes are not going up much at all. So programmatically, the tax credit program will allow you to raise rents on those folks. Functionally, that doesn't work to maintain affordability. And I think you need to draw a distinction between what we're technically allowed to do under the tax credit rules and what we will actually do. Right. Oh. So as a mission-driven organization, we're not going to raise rents to the maximum possible rent for our tenants just because we can do it. We might do it because we need to pay our bills, but we're not going to gratuitously squeeze every dollar out of the tenants we can. And you see functionally a lot of organizations, nonprofits, public agencies not raise their rents all the way to the ceiling in an environment like this.
Okay.
But we could. Technically, you know, it's a shortcoming of the program. The affordability metrics are different than you get for Section 8, where it's pegged to actual income, right? So it does create that potential issue, and we have to be really careful about how we implement it to make sure that it doesn't adversely affect the tenants.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure, yeah. So for affordability for 4% credits, beyond the federal requirements, there are none. However, we often voluntarily put additional affordability on 4% deals because it allows us to receive a higher limit for the total costs we can include in the tax credit transaction. And in an environment like this one where everything is outlandishly expensive, we often have to provide affordability deeper than the federal requirements for 4% deals. This is, to get back to your question, the way that TCAC or tax credit rents are set, first off, you have to meet the affordability requirements of every funding source that's there. So if you've got state HCD or if you've got City of Oakland money, they might impose an affordability requirement that's deeper than what tax credit program requires. And so in every case, you need to take the most restrictive requirement. So if the City of Oakland says 40% and TCAC says 50%, you're going to 40%. Doesn't matter what TCAC says. there's a requirement for 9% deals where you have to be 10% below market. I will do cartwheels in this room if that is ever applicable in the City of Oakland again, because we're always so far below market because of the expensiveness of the market that it's just never going to be a factor. But it's a rule there. I don't think I can do a cartwheel, but I'll try. I'll absolutely try. And so the way the rents are set, the maximum TCAC rent is actually based off 30% of the area median income at the designated AMI level. So that's a distinct difference with the Section 8 program where it's 30% of the actual income of the tenant, right? So you could have a tenant who's making 20% of area median income. If they're in a 30% unit, then they have to pay 30% of 30%, not 30% of 20%. And so that can create gaps in affordability, and it can reduce it can increase housing cost burden on tenants. But, you know, in 1986, this seemed like a great idea. That's the way the program is structured. And as sponsors, we can do stuff to mitigate that. We can also continue to provide subsidy, so on and so forth. But it's an issue. It's an issue. And so to give you a sample of what that looks like right now in Alameda County, you can see for two people, the area median income is $93,000 a year. So for a 50% unit, that means the maximum income that a tenant could have to be in that unit would be $46,500. Somebody making less than that could theoretically occupy that unit. But that's the absolute maximum they can make. And what that translates into for rent, say those two people are living in a one-bedroom apartment, 50% AMI gets you to $1,090 a month. So you can see that, for lower-income residents, that's still a stretch. And we have to, we have to be conscious of that. There are people who would benefit from that. I mean, there are plenty of people who work jobs at that kind of middle-income price point for which this makes sense, and it's okay to support them with affordable housing, but it doesn't necessarily address the needs of the most directly impacted individuals.
So I'm trying to hold my questions until each section.
You can break in whenever you want.
If we drop a Section 8 voucher on top of a unit, mm-hmm. that deepens the subsidy. That's what we do, right?
That's correct, yeah. So if you have...
we could
serve lower income.
Absolutely, yeah. So if you had a 60% tax credit, or a 60% AMI tax credit unit, mm-hmm. but you had somebody who's holding a housing choice voucher that right. wanted to move into that, yeah. the person holding that voucher would still only pay 30% of their income, and the property would get the rest from the housing authority.
Great. Yeah. And my other question was the rent as through the life of the renter, like does it fluctuate AMI wise with the life of it, or do they come in at a certain AMI and then stay there, because sure. even that's dangerous, or do they have to go up and down?
Yeah, so the AMI level for any given unit is determined by the unit itself and not by the renter. So if it's a 50% AMI unit, a renter comes in at 48% AMI current income, they lose their job, they drop down, the rent is still at 50% AMI. And as a property owner, we can make the decision whether or not to raise their rent when the AMI goes up. We can make the decision to, you know, reset the rent based on circumstances to try to keep people housed. But the regulatory requirement is still going to be pegged to the annual area median income and whatever percent TCAC has designated that particular unit at.
Correct. I think my question is do we increase the rent every year for the AMI that right. goes up or down?
We can,
but yeah. usually we don't, I presume?
Well, sometimes we do. It really depends. I mean, it's a management decision, you know. And, you know, we've got an obligation to continue paying our bills and paying our debt, so we have yeah. to balance that with the well-being of the tenants. And I think, you know, those decisions are typically made on an annual basis.
You know. Well, you're shedding light on a situation where the seniors often come to me when they're in these buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And they absolutely have no idea why their rent went up, because they're not even clear about what type of unit that they're renting.
Right.
So there's a lot of transparency that is needed in these tax credit buildings that we need to educate our
sure.
tenants a little bit more. And some are paying this rent, some are paying that rent, and then their rent goes up and down, mm-hmm. and they're just not getting any really direct answers. And I think it's a problem with the industry.
I agree. I mean, we need to make sure everybody's informed.
Yeah.
You know, we can do our best. We can't tell our nonprofit partners to do their best. I hope they will. But, you know, ultimately,
sure.
we want to be as good as we can be within this organization. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So this is a little bit esoteric, but, you know, to get to the heart of how much tax credit equity you can get for any particular building. I talked briefly about something called eligible basis, and it basically means that, you know, you will be granted a certain amount of tax credits based on the cost of acquiring, rehabilitating, or constructing a building. So this doesn't include land, it doesn't include cash reserves or anything like that, but it does include anything related to construction. So architecture, for instance, is construction related. You would be able to claim tax credits on that cost. My former employers actually put together the slideshow, and you'll see that last bullet says consultant experienced professional. I will still do their marketing for them. You should still consult an experienced professional, but hopefully we've got some of the answers in-house these days. So a sample quick budget, and I wish I could work on a building that only cost $6.4 million, but you know, say we had a development budget where land was $1 million, construction costs were $4 million, construction-related soft costs, such as architecture, was $1 million, and reserves were $400,000, total of $6.4 million. Of those costs, only the two middle ones, the hard construction costs and the soft costs, would be eligible for tax credits. So even though the building cost $6.4 million to build, we could only claim tax credits on $5 million of that.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's typically a pretty good ratio. You'll usually get basis on 70-80% of your costs, depending on land costs is usually a big variable. So how does that work in the calculation? I'm literally the only person in this room that needs to know this, but I'll put this out there anyway. So if we've got $5 million of eligible basis and we have 100% of the building be affordable, that's what they call the applicable fraction, we would have $5 million of qualified basis. If only half of the building was affordable, we'd only get $2.5 million out of that. We'd multiply that by the tax credit rate for a 9% deal. The tax credit rate is always 9%, conveniently enough. And so that means you get $450,000 in tax credits per year. That's 9% of $5 million. You get to claim the credits over 10 years. So that means your total tax credits you'd get in this case would be $4.5 million. If you got a dollar from your investor for every tax credit, you would get a clean $4.5 million in equity. So, you know, for 4% deals, which is what we're mostly going to be working on, I would typically peg the amount of tax credit equity per dollar of basis that we generated at about 40 cents on the dollar. It's a rough estimate at today's pricing. So it gives you an idea if you've got $10 million of construction cost, you could expect to get $4 million in tax credit equity.
So the tax credit equity then is usually tied to the tax credit value. Is that how that works?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, there are a number of factors, but the one that is most directly impacting it is what the tax credit market is doing at any given time. You know, even though there's been a lot of turmoil in the tax credit market because of tax reform and because of certain behaviors of the current administration, you know, we've had a fairly stable pricing range of 95 cents to a dollar around Oakland lately. That's held that way for about 2 years, but that's a big shock from pre-2016 when we were getting $1.20. So there can be significant changes over time.
Oh, I see. So in the past then, it was possible to actually leverage the equity that you got from the limited partners.
Well, you wouldn't leverage it necessarily. Well, I mean, you do leverage it.
I mean, I guess leverage is probably a bad word.
Yeah.
But you could get $1.2 for dollar invested.
Yeah.
And looking even farther back, when they first started this program, and this would be actually in the late 90s, I can remember we got above 90 cents to 93, and that was the highest ever placed when we got it, and then it continued to go up. So it historically was below 90. Wow. For a long period of time, and settling back to that only just changes our puzzle a little bit. Of course, we don't have redevelopment anymore, and there are some things that we would need to fill the gaps. But the program functioned when it was in the 90s and even the high 80s. So, you know, it could function again, but we're going to have to find a few other sources to fill the gaps.
Right. Yeah, just need more soft money.
So it just moves with the market.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, the tax reform made the credits significantly less valuable, not because of the limit, you know, the tax liability.
Tax rates went down.
So that's right, so depreciation wasn't worth as much, right? Corporate tax rate used to be 35%, now it's 20-something, and, you know, that makes a difference. So.
And the market changed. You had, when I was talking, before it started moving up to the 90s and then 100, and above 100, it was some people who really needed tax breaks. Major corporations and insurance companies started investing in this. Prior to that, your syndicator really had to work to get investors. Became less and less challenging. And now with some of the tax breaks that were promised initially by the Trump administration really impacted these. And a lot of people, if you can remember, early last year were going into sort of shortfall in their deals because the tax credits were not syndicating because people were anticipating the corporate tax rate to drop.
Oh. Yeah, all right. Cool. Awesome.
Yep. Okay, so these next two slides, I apologize. I should have cut them. They are redundant. So I'm going to skip over these two 9% and 4% tax credit slides, excuse me, and skip forward to the private conventional or tax-exempt debt slide. And so this is just a kind of a primer on the loans we take out as kind of the first mortgage on these deals. It's a little different than the old days when HUD would simply cut you a check or give you a 0% loan on a deal and you didn't have to deal with the bank. With the tax credit program, we typically have to go to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Union Bank to get, you know, a first mortgage like any multifamily developer would. They require regular monthly payments secured against the property through a lien once you get into the permanent phase. It's not the case in the construction phase. And, you know, typically the loans will only be recourse during construction. With recourse meaning that, you know, the general partner or the guarantor is required to pay if the partnership can't. A big reason for that is because during the construction period, the loan amount usually exceeds the value of the property. So if you've ever done a loan for a home or whatever, you know that they'll lend you 80% of the value of the home. And it's the case in the multifamily market too. So we can typically borrow up to 80 or 85% of the value of the property. The rest has to come from other sources. But during construction, we need more than that. So we have to provide a personal guarantee to pay back the loan. Cash flow, as we talked about, there are, various uses of cash flow. You see that a lot of these are general partner related uses, and that's intentional. We want to structure the deal such that we have as many buckets to catch the cash flow as possible so that none of it trickles down to the investor at the very end of the line. So things we use to catch it include deferred developer fee, our partnership management fee, loans that we might make to the project. If we have to pay out our guarantees, that can be refunded through cash flow. Soft debt repayments, this can be much to our advantage if we're purchasing a property from ourselves. We'll typically have large seller loans that are to an housing authority related entity that can sop up cash flow. And then, some ground lease payments as well. If for whatever reason money gets through all of that, then the limited partner will claim at least 10% of it. Sometimes they'll claim 99.99% of it, but given the structure of the deals we're talking about, I would never anticipate that to happen. So we would typically get cash flow after we paid expenses and debt service.
What is the difference between asset management fees and partnership management fees?
Mostly the party who's collecting them. So partnership management fee is something that the general partner gets for managing the partnership, like filing the franchise tax board fees, all that stuff.
Oh, it's not for managing the property.
No, it's not a property management fee. That's right. It's for managing the partnership, not for the property. Right.
Okay.
And the asset management fee for the limited partner is just their compliance department taking a few bucks to pay their bills.
And what's the incentive management fee?
An incentive management fee is typically something that the investor and the sponsor can agree to in order to prevent money from getting to the bottom of the waterfall and being paid out to the investor. You know, most investors don't want cash flow. It counteracts if the limited partner gets cash flow, it creates additional tax liability. And the entire point of their involvement in the partnership is to shield themselves from tax liability, so they don't want the cash. So they'll set up this incentive management fee, which basically says, hey, general partner, you've done a great job of controlling costs, and because you controlled costs from the operating budget and the debt service, you actually get to keep the money. And that's just another way for us to sop up cash flow. In the deals we're talking about, we'll have other ways to do it. Probably we'll never get to have an incentive management fee, but the money will get into our pocket somehow.
Thank you.
Nice.
And so, there will be certain reserves that are required through tax credit properties. This is a little different than, what you would see in our traditional public housing model where we've got one big bucket of funds controlled by the housing authority. Instead, each partnership will have its own reserves for that specific property. There are a number of reserves that we might be forced to carry. The first is capital replacement reserves. And it's basically to replace refrigerators and do other capital improvements during the 15-year period. Those can be funded up front. They will also be funded through monthly deposits, usually somewhere between $300 and $600 a month per unit, or excuse me, a year per unit. There's also a capitalized operating reserve. We touched on that a little bit before. It's related to the operating deficit guarantee. Usually those are 3 to 6 months of debt and expenses to make sure we can keep the lights on if something goes wrong and we are unable to collect our rent. If we have a lot of Section 8 in the deal, there might be a transition reserve. So that's a way of the investor guarding against the potential loss of the Section 8 subsidy, whether that be through federal defunding of the program or some other reason why the property might lose Section 8. We try to keep, try to have an investor relationship that won't require that, but, you never know. If we have a permanent supportive housing type product, we're sometimes required to keep a services reserve on hand to make sure that the resident services are continued. For a normal family development, we typically would not have that because our, the services load is not that much. But if you need intensive case management, you need to be a little more careful about it. And so one thing that we have to do is when we draft the limited partnership agreement and the other option documents, we need to make sure we protect these reserves and put in language that says that the investor can't take them when they leave the partnership. And so, you know, we've learned that lesson over time, and we're pretty good about it now. But some of the buyouts we're doing right now, we didn't have that language in there, and so there's a little bit of a discussion about who gets to keep the money.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned that at some point I think it was early in this piece, something about secure loans, was it? I missed
it. Recourse loans, is it?
The recourse, the lender has a judgment can cancel if the CAIR is insufficient to pay. I was wondering if how we secure this loan to, like, we'll take care of it if anything happens, mm-hmm. right? Is that against property? Is it secured against property so that if something happens, they could take back the property, or is it secured against something else?
Yeah, so when it's non-recourse, so in other words, when the housing authority or you know, one of our affiliate organizations is not providing a guarantee for the loan, yes, it's secured with the land. So in theory, okay. if we went into default, the lender could take back the land.
Good, good. So that is a secured loan.
That's right.
Do we usually, I think we're our own bank. We don't usually get loans from Wells Fargo or Bank of America where we have, like, mortgage payments. Do yeah. we do that?
Sometimes we do. So, for instance, at Foothill, we've got a loan. It's not a particularly big one, but it's with a bank called Hanmi Bank. Mm-hmm. I think they were an affordable housing lender for roughly 3 months because every time we call them on the phone, they never know what we're talking about. But, you know, we still have a loan. It was a few million dollars. We paid it off over time. But it's still there, and we have to make mortgage payments on a monthly basis, and it acts like a real mortgage. And
that's not our regular business model, though, because I don't remember having too many of them in our portfolio.
It's not how we've typically done things, but then again, we've not done traditional tax credit development very frequently. We have some mixed finance deals we participate in, but, you know, generally speaking, that's not been how we've built things. And, you know, there's nothing that says you have to have a permanent loan on a project. You know, you can go without one if you want, but you have to find the money from somewhere. And
we have to find it, and we're very
right, yeah.
creative about doing that.
Yeah, well, so for the Oak Groves, for instance, we're going to have a sizable permanent loan. And because of the amount of cash flow that the Section 8 project, or the Section 8 vouchers are going to generate at that property, we will have the money to pay for it. And, you know, I think it's a matter of wanting to keep our cash freed up so that we can do other activities at other properties and continue moving forward and developing rather than paying a substantial chunk to that property up front. Yeah.
So on that particular property, we will have a loan.
That's correct. We will.
Okay. We do or we will have?
We will. So right now we don't because it's just public housing. And
you'll notify us of all this.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We've already had some discussion of that on prior Oak Groves resolutions. It's one of the reasons why we're no longer putting forth $16 million to fund the property is because we're borrowing it from a third party instead. But, you know, we will also come back to this board for authorization of all the private financing probably at some point in January or February.
Okay.
So.
And I'll leave the final questions at the end of your presentation.
Oh, okay, great. Well, we're getting pretty near the end. So to get back to the question of what happens at year 15 when the limited partner exits, this is a pretty important part of the deal because you don't want to put yourself at risk of losing the property, and it's the type of thing that can happen. It's one of the big risks in doing a low-income housing tax credit development. So the terms of the exit are always agreed upon in a limited partnership agreement, and it's typically there's an option agreement embedded in the limited partnership agreement. And, there are typically two ways that we can acquire the property. The first is through an option, which basically means we have the option to purchase the limited partner's interest of the property or the entire property after the 15-year credit compliance period has exhausted itself. And in some cases, we can do that after year 12. It's negotiated with the investor. But, you know, 15 years is a general rule of thumb. The other option we have to purchase the property is the right of first refusal, where if a third party makes an offer to the limited partner to purchase the property, we can come in for a set price that we've already pre-negotiated and buy the property instead. And so, either one of these allows either the purchase of the entire property or just the limited partner's interest. We typically try to purchase the limited partner's interest because it does not trigger a transfer tax, and that can be substantial. And so on our recent buyout of Chestnut and Linden, we were able to purchase the limited partner interest, and that's saved us hundreds of thousands of dollars in transfer taxes, which is unambiguously good. So for an option, you know, their typical terms would be the greater of fair market value or alternatively the outstanding debt plus taxes. So you're either going to step into the limited partner's shoes and assume all the debt that's currently on the property, or you have to pay them the fair market value if that's higher. You usually establish the fair market value by getting an appraisal done, but for the purposes of figuring out how much the property is valued, you have to deduct any outstanding debt. So if you've got $8 million of debt outstanding on the property, but it appraises at $10 million, the actual value of the property to the seller, the limited partner, would be $2 million. So it reduces the amount that you would potentially have to pay. You may or may not have to pay exit taxes for the limited partner. And increasingly, we are requesting that they price a projected exit tax into the price of the credits so we don't have the obligation at year 15. In that case, we would typically have to pay exit taxes if they were greater than what was originally projected, but it still allows us to insulate ourselves from having a big tax bill when the investor leaves the property. Usually we get 12 to 36 months to exercise the option, and it usually comes before the right of first refusal. Right of first refusal is actually something, the terms are all established very clearly by the tax code. Price has to be the assumption of debt plus any exit taxes, and it is only available after the 15-year initial period has run its course. Debate as to whether or not an offer to purchase the property that triggers the right of first refusal has to be a bona fide offer. So in the past, you've been able to go to one of your buddies who runs another nonprofit and say, hey, will you please make an offer on this so we can trigger the right of first refusal? But there's some debate as to whether or not that's legal, so we can't always count on that. And so for exit taxes, which is one of the parts of the components of the price that we talked about, generally speaking, exit taxes come up for the investor when the tax benefits they receive exceed the amount of money they have invested in the property. So if they take $15 million in depreciation but only paid $10 million for the privilege of doing so, they gain $5 million, and they have to pay exit tax, capital gains tax, based on that $5 million. That taxable capital gain typically gets passed on to us. And so we have to be really careful about how we structure the deal, such that, A, we try to price as much of that up front as we can so there are no surprises at year 15, and, B, limit their depreciation to the point where we don't expect it to cause them to incur more losses than they invested in the property. It's not a perfect science, but it's one of the areas where we have to be really, really careful up front to make sure that we don't have a huge liability on the back end.
So is that sort of similar to like a recapture notion in the property?
It's basically, you know, it's if it's a gain on a capital asset, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, just like if they had got a property and it appreciated in value by $5 million and they sold it, they'd have to pay taxes on that $5 million. If they claim tax losses on depreciation, same thing. They get a financial benefit, so it's taxable.
Yeah, but I think the recapture works that if you have depreciated the property, then you, like, let's say you bought the property for $10 million, sold it for $15 million, mm-hmm. Your liability would be more than the $5 million gain, because it would also include the amount of depreciation you deducted, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
You have to pay for the tax benefits you claim. You always do. So. We've got a few ways we can pay exit taxes or the cost of a year 15 exit if we have to. We can either refinance and use the proceeds to take out, you know, the investor obligation. We can re-syndicate with a new allocation of tax credits and use those proceeds to pay, you know, the investor to exit. Both of those things typically don't happen because of the time frame required to actually refinance or re-syndicate a property. It's not practical to do so. And, you know, you try not to leverage yourself to convince the investor to exit anyway. We can also apply cash reserves to pay exit taxes. And so this is what we did at Chestnut Linden, right? We made an agreement where we would pay the investor $125,000 to go away, and we used the operating reserve that we funded to pay that $125,000. So that was a very much a win-win. property was structured well and everything worked out the right way. And if, you know, worst comes to worst, we just pay for it out of our own pocket, you know. And I never want that to happen, but we may make the decision that it's worth hanging onto a property and doing so. That's it. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Yeah, I just have one more. On page 32, it said the fair market value established per appraisal, but any outstanding debt deducted obligation to pay exit taxes can vary. Help me understand that.
Okay, sure. So if, you know, if the option, if the, so the price on an option is typically the greater of a fair market value or the amount of outstanding debt plus exit taxes that the investor owes, right? And so if it turns out that the fair market value is the higher of those two numbers, you'd go and you get an appraisal to establish the fair market value. But when you consider what the investor is owed when they receive fair market value for the property, you would have to deduct outstanding debt, right? Because if you own a property for $10 million but you owe $8 million in debt, to the seller, the value of that property is actually only $2 million. And when I say the obligation to pay exit taxes may vary, that's a term that's negotiated in the limited partnership agreement. So depending on how the limited partnership agreement is structured, we could either pay all of the investors' exit taxes, none of the investors' exit taxes, or anything in between. But, you know, the devil is in the details, and, you know, we have to pay attention to how we structure that.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. Fine job.
Or do we have another question? You are welcome.
No. Yes. Fine
I
job.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So this is the one I'm holding for last.
Okay.
So Oakland Housing Authority has X number of buildings across Oakland under these complicated long-term deals, correct? X number of buildings?
Yeah, I'm not sure how many tax credit buildings we own as the sort of primary owner. I think that the two that come to mind are Foothill and Tessaferanga.
So there's not that many?
Like, well, we're participants in a lot of mixed finance deals where we have public housing units, but there's another sponsor who's the managing general partner.
So there's a lot of liability out there. And I'm using the word liability because we're responsible for a lot of units across the city of Oakland and that have these complicated, you know, structures in it, financial structures in it. And I don't know why I'm going to this to here, but I guess it's just my mind, because I understand that there's a lot of catastrophes that happen because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm kind of concerned is if we have a huge earthquake, which we expect every year to have, what happens to these buildings if we lose them with these complicated financial responsibilities and structures attached to them? I presume insurance. But it can't be that simple. What happens to these guys when they something like that really happens?
So, yeah, I mean, first we would rely on insurance. And, I mean, if it's a giant canyon opens up in the Bay Area and swallows everything up, the insurance companies are probably going to be challenged to pay everybody out. You know, everybody understands that. In the limited partnership agreements, when we negotiate them up front, we typically have language in there that is related to casualty. And so that'll mean that, you know, the use of the insurance proceeds will be determined. And in some cases, the agreement will be that we will use those proceeds to rebuild the project. In some cases, it means that we will just write off the project as a loss, and we will have to pay out the various lenders and investors what they're owed. But that's typically agreed to up front.
So you're saying there is language in the contracts that would kind of support us
generally
not
speaking,
being
I'm going to be completely honest with you that, like, the challenges raised by climate change and the potential for absolute disaster is unprecedented. And
frankly, we
don't know what's going to happen. I mean, maybe it will cause widespread displacement within the Bay Area. We're going to have to move uphill, all those things. I really don't know if there's much we can do to guard against that absent just not building any more housing. You know, I mean, no, we can be careful about where we build, but ultimately we've got an obligation to continue housing people, and I think it's worth the risk to do that and, you know, cross the climate change bridge later, frankly. But
well, I'm glad you said that, but there must be some, I mean, that's the part that we have to actually do think about things like that, and how do we recover financially and physically. I mean, it's a big, huge issue that no one is thinking about, and we can't just say, okay, we'll take care of it when it happens, because that's too late.
Well, but
I don't want you to think about it now. I'm just saying that's, for some reason, that's where my mind went, because we're so responsible for so many people and so many buildings, and it's huge responsibility. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, what if something happens? How do we get back on our feet?
Right.
And, you know, and I don't answer that now, but I'm hoping some of us start kind of thinking about it.
Well, I would just... You know, I'm going to be staring at my ceiling all night worrying about this now, so thank you. But it's good. It's a good thing to worry about. No, you're fine.
I'm so sorry.
But I would just add, for the Section 8 program, having assisted with one earthquake, the Northridge, which I actually volunteered in the park, where we set up temporary emergency access to services, including phones, because no one had cell phones at that time. But what happens to the voucher holders, and this would be project-based or otherwise, is they're issued FEMA vouchers, and they can move anywhere. When Katrina hit New Orleans, they literally bussed everybody into Houston, and we sent staff at the agency I was with to help them issue vouchers. And that's why I was so adamant about getting a business system outside of our geographic area.
I want you to know I thought of that.
Because that's really what happens. Yeah. And what remains is the shell of a building that you're going to have to deal with one way or another, and how that's going to play out, I don't know.
Right. Well, thank you for that, because I do know we have had some conversations about it, but then this just took it to a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. It's like there's this infrastructure that we're responsible for, and I was just curious, you know, what happens to all of that. Sure. But thank you so much.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I would just add that generically, I know that we are responsible for 15,000 households, you know, and I take that very seriously. So that there are risks involved with this, but there are risks we have to take to continue expanding access to affordable housing, and we have to weigh those two things. So we're acutely aware of it. And,
and lastly, let me commend you.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I just want to make a quick comment that I have to thank you so much for this PowerPoint. I'm a Hauser and been doing it for a long time, but I listened to so many of the presentations that I'm like, what are we talking about here? You made it very user-friendly. Thank you.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to use this and pass it on.
Oh, absolutely. Please do. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you.
Fine job.
Thank you, yes.
Put your name on it next time.
You allowed even us to understand. Okay, so we are now moving to item D, recognition of people wishing to address the commission. We have three speaker cards. One is from a little difficulty reading the name. It looks like Natuski Noel. Natasha Noel.
And if you can state your name in the mic, and you'll have 3 minutes.
Hello, good evening. Natasha Noel. Natusha, that's my new name, huh? Hi to you all. I'm concerned. First of all, I'd like to say, for the people, by the people, power to the people. I hear a lot about a lot of everything besides really talking about what about the people, okay? Because the reality is that one hotel that you were talking about, this was years and years and years ago, it closed down, right? And we're still dealing with that. And the other one, it's like, I'm like, it's almost like we're not a joke, right? Because in reality, I'm walking with the people. I'm out there. I'm seeing while I'm going through my own case and trying to find a way to see clear, you know, and to handle my business with your lower echelon, you know, I'm meeting more and more people who have lost their housing vouchers, who are, you know, are on the street, and then they disappear or whatever, you know. I mean, there's a lot going on. And I think that we really need to take time, a little bit of this time, and really get a bit more serious about the people that we're here representing, right? Because you are here representing the people. And I know all the all that financial hobnob, whatever, that all that stuff that really, are you serious, dude? Okay, it's a joke. It's really a joke. And I'm so sorry, because I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I'm like, And I'm sorry, that I don't want to talk about Ann Griffith when she's not here, so maybe we'll save that for next month. But in reality, my life has been, I'm like, what's going on? With my property, where I'm sitting, I have been under, feeling like it's, you know, it's, I just don't feel safe. I don't feel safe, okay? There's no security that I should be able to have right of first refusal if my house should get sold from underneath me, right? I should have that right of first refusal. The housing, I was supposed to go into the homeownership aspect of your program, right? Well, with the likes of Ann Griffith, this huckster, and Kevin Skipper, I might not ever get there, right? The single-family residencies are being bought out, and yeah, we're doing a lot of that. If you go on online, you can see how much Housing Authority HUD owns, right? Pre-foreclosure, okay, what is that? That's a term that somebody here must have coined, pre-foreclosure. I mean, what are we doing to help the people? Because we're not. The 3 to 6 months, you guys have like a whatever you were referencing, there's like some kind of money available and get, you know, to secure your investments, but what about the investments of the people? Okay, there was no 3 to 6 months offered to my landlord. Okay, well, I dealt with you all. There wasn't, okay? This is my second time around, and this has been 2 years now almost. So since 2016, when you came in, it just so happens that, you know, a whole lot of people were displaced. Displacement, that word should not be used lightly at all, sir, okay? So it's like, all of a sudden, your own legal department told me I could move anywhere I wanted to go. Now, we knew that was a lie. I can't move anywhere I want to go, okay? I understand that a lot of people were moved out of Oakland, okay? Right in my area of East Oakland alone, a lot of people lost their vouchers and were moved out, ported out to Antioch. You know, and I guess that's okay to do. Has it been 3 minutes?
Yeah.
So what I'm asking is that, and I really appreciate the one entity that I feel has been a little bit concerned about my case and getting things rectified, but I need to know that we're going to, you know, what are we doing about, what are we doing here? What are we doing? And without the people, you guys aren't going to, I mean, it's just, we're big business, but we're nonprofit. What is this? I might not make any sense here to most people, but I'm tired now, and a lot of people are tired too. And our communities have been usurped. And do you guys really care about keeping low income people here?
If you can wrap up.
You don't. Please, we got to get serious about this because you're a joke, okay? And Oakland is not a joke. My biological parents died for this place, basically. You know. And you have run, the heart and soul is being run out of here. We got to be more aware of what's going on. More aware, please. And that PowerPoint was bunk, okay? We can do a lot better than that. I'm sorry. And I really appreciate the questions you asked. We all should have questions, right?
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much. And again, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be emotional, but really, it's like slicksters.
Okay, well, thank you for your comments. Okay, we have two more. We have Zenda Johnson.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Zenda Johnson. I live at 582 48th Street. I just wanted to address, on our street, one side of the street, they tore down the houses that were there. To build apartment complexes. There were many rodents that came from those houses and were running all on our complex to where they were out there scaring the raccoons. So, of course, we were scared. Also, the people that moved into those units on the complex use our garbage can for dumpsters. They also come into our parking lot to park. And the people on the corner to the right, they party, and you have alcohol bottles in our parking lot. And this is what they do. I think they party every weekend. And also, I wanted to ask if we can have some markings for our parking because we don't have lines. So, you know, sometimes where there are five cars that can fit, only three cars are fitting there because we don't have any lines. And then my rent is being raised. I'm a working tenant, and my rent is being raised, but I don't have any of the amenities that the apartments that we're being based on, you know, our rent is being based on. I don't have any of those amenities. So I wanted to know if we can do something some landscaping to revitalize the complex. At least I can, you know, walk outside and it looks pretty. I'll be satisfied with that. And the homeless population, it's really scary because they break our gates to kind of get to the neighboring areas. And they're right there on the where the freeway is. So they're constantly putting holes in our gates. We have children there. So people, my neighbors who have small children, their children can just run to the freeway, you know. Yeah. And I think, oh, and also in our complex, they don't even have benches for the elderly. So we have one disabled neighbor. She can't, I think I've only seen her once, and I've been there for a few years. And, you know, just to have, I was just thinking about her being able to sit outside and enjoy the sunlight in the summer, you know, and she, you know, just something for her. Yeah. That's it.
Well, I thank you very much.
So thank you. I appreciate everything you said, yeah. And I'm going to talk to Andres to see what we may need your help meeting with some of the neighbors.
All right, okay. Good.
All right.
Good. Because this sounds like security issues.
And it's also adjoining sites. And, yeah. And but I want to tell you that having been here for 11 years, to have you come and yes. talk about the neighborhood the way you just did is meaningful to me.
Thank you.
And I truly appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
Okay.
So Andres, thank you.
All right.
Yeah, we thank you as well because this kind of information is really, this is important to us because this is stuff we can follow up on.
So I'll be in contact, all right?
Thank you.
Yeah, we do. Okay, and then we have another one that's kind of hard to read. Is this Kashan? Kashan? Oh, okay, yes.
So I was here last month and I held my tongue. I stay at 582, 48th Street 2. Our maintenance, which Eric don't know about, because every time I try to get to Eric, I get knocked down. I've been there for 10 years. I've been asking for new paint. My neighbor number two, the sewer's been flooding in her house 2 times in 1 month. They just now changing her carpet. My neighbor number three, her refrigerator go out. She got a son with no kidneys. It take 2 or 3 days for the maintenance people to come. They don't maintenance nothing. Our gutters are dirty. I keep on asking them to clean our gutters. They ain't clean. Because the gutters make mildew when the water sucks up in the apartment building. That's why our kids be sick. And the parking situation, it was supposed to be tubs put out there. I had a meeting with Andreas. I had a meeting with Mark. Leah, everybody knows about this. It's nothing new that's going on. Every time I try to get to Eric, I get dropped to the bottom. It's nothing new that's going on. They know about our apartment building. It's a billion-dollar project next to us. They don't care about us. We live like we live in low income. We shouldn't have to live like that. We pay our rent on time. We pay our rent every month. Why do we got to live like that? They brought Miss Connie to clean that shit up because they knew it was wrong. Miss Connie, Leah wasn't doing nothing. Jenny McGill, her people's house caught on fire. They moved her people's. She moved her people's in another apartment. But y'all ain't got no vouchers. Y'all can't move nobody. She moved her people's. What happened to Anderson? Please, it's too much going on that you never knew about. And that's why I held my tongue last month. But this month, I got to let it out because it's too much. It's too much. And I've been there for 10 years. They just now changed Miss Arnett's carpet that's been there for 46 years. And her house then got flooded from the apartment upstairs. And they just now changing her carpet 3 days ago. We had a mandatory meeting on Friday. Only 3 people showed up. And it's a mandatory meeting for a 10 unit. It's nothing. What the maintenance man say? Oh, my neighbor number 6 been had an order ever since October of last year, and she still got mildew climbing up her walls with 4 kids in her house. And this is what go on that everybody know about it. And it keep making me mad because I try to spare everybody feelings, spare because I work for y'all. I do an IC. I got a bad heart, but I still get out there and make sure that garbage get empty. Make sure nobody park in that spot on Sundays and Wednesdays so y'all don't have to keep on paying for that garbage to get empty. Make sure nobody blocking the garbage so it can get empty. Make sure the parking lot is cleaned up. Make sure the leaves, I've been called Caltrans, asked them to cut the leaves. They cut the trees. They still there. I've been reported, had meetings, everything. Where was Leah? Why was Leah getting paid? That's what I want to know because Leah never, everything I'm saying, she's been new. before James got put over, before Miss Connie, Leah, when Leah came in, and Katira, what did they get paid for? Because they didn't do nothing. They didn't do nothing to our building. They didn't know. Our building is still the same. It's never got a wash down. It's spiders rolled up our walls. Ants, rats, raccoons, all that. They don't do inspections. We got an inspection on the 25th. I bet you they come tomorrow and ask us what's wrong with our apartment building. And that's the bad part about it. They don't care. Then when you go to maintenance, what do you say? I can only do so much with housing. Give me money for. Hold on. This is your job to help us. And this is what's going on, Eric. And you need to really look into it, because somebody is going to get in big trouble if one of them kids die of mildew or something over there, because that building is not intact. Trust me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah,
yes,
we
have it right here.
Thank you.
So are you going to follow up on that?
Not only our building is at 14, period. A grumble from Baker Street had mice and rats, big ticks, everything. She's still in apartment 10. They just moved her from Baker Street after 2 years, and she got pictures and everything. So it's at 14, period. When the people came and took the garbage, they said this is the worst apps over here, but the garbage is really bad over here. And they don't understand. People don't, y'all don't understand what's going on, for real. People need to look into it.
Okay, so we are now moving to written communications.
Written communications. We have the usual monthly report. I do want to point one thing out. It's on page 19. We added a new table, which is trying to count the number of families that we serve versus how many we're sort of obligated under HUD. Mm-hmm. And there's one error on I want to correct, but it's a little new, so I want to kind of walk it through. We have the total number of vouchers in our program is 12,800.
What page was that?
It's page 19. 12,874. And then we add our special programs that are all within that allocation that HUD gives us. So what we're trying to do is let you, in a much more realistic way, see the number of families that we have, see how many vouchers we currently have. And if you look under the MTW program, we have a total of 12,874 families that we have as a baseline. This past month, we served 12,274. So we have 600 families that we could serve. Then you take the special programs out of there. We have pending 100 in THP Plus and CalWORKs, another 102 of the SROs that are still being processed for the families, and that gets you down, plus some for the sponsor base, to get you down to about 375 vouchers. We have 151 people out searching with vouchers right now, so you can see how we're working toward the 100%. The other thing that Michelle Hassan is doing is making sure she has vouchers available for the project base awards when they come offline. So that's the balance. If you go below the light green table, you have the other non-MTW programs. These are standard programs that have discrete funding that can't be funged. And it gives you some of the lease up on that and where we are. For example, on VASH, we just got an allotment of 75 new vouchers. So we have 81 that we can lease, and we've got a number of out searching. The one correction I have is the total families served, instead of the 14,000 and change, it actually didn't tally right. It should be 13,794. So with that correction, the table seems accurate. And that's all I have for the monthly report, but we're here for any questions.
That's actually a nice chart. I mean, I find it very useful.
Well, we're trying to track against our obligation, exceed it.
Yeah,
so I wanted
right.
to find some way of showing how we serve more families than HUD gives us money for, basically. And that's kind of the best thing we came up with. To walk you through the written communications beyond the monthly report is we have just a memo on where we are with smoking and lease enforcement and some of the efforts that we've done. And again, any ideas anyone has, any resources were missed, please let me know, because we'd be happy to pass them on to the managers at the site.
So I'm sure you know about Keep Oakland House, the $9 million that's coming into the city of Oakland.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how that's going to necessarily happen.
Exactly.
I got one email over the weekend from an elected official asking,
how is
I
that going to happen? Yeah.
And so, but it would be very helpful.
On page 16, it looks like there were 47 residents that are delinquent rent and have some noncompliance issue. It would be wonderful just to make sure that we're on the front lines, because it's prevention money.
It is.
So that means it's to keep people housed. So,
and I'm not sure how they're doing it. So I don't know I was, you know, I know about it the way you know about it. I don't know much more and how people access it, but I understand it's going to be some through some of the existing people, like Catholic Charities.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct.
And some of the challenges we have is the amount they're willing
to pay to help.
And you can't go back twice.
Right, so, for Catholic Charities. So yeah. We should bring that up with the mayor.
And I think it's Seasons of Charity, and I will.
Yeah. I'll help you.
Because I think those are things that are part of the current system that aren't working.
Absolutely. So I don't mind stepping in and writing a letter to her so that she understands that it's unrealistic. If you really want to keep people housed, you need to be more flexible. And it's not her. I know that
I'm not sure if this money will come without those strings or not. So I'll let you know as soon as I hear something.
Okay.
Yeah. In terms of the policy, we have the smoke-free. We have... I also just, Dave did a memo updating you on just Bridge Housing's negotiations with the Limited Partnership for Chestnut and Linden. We're very happy how that came out, and I just wanted to put this for the record down the road, so if anybody's searching for it, they can find it. But I'm happy with that one, and that'll make 2 and 3 that we're exiting on the 15-year deal, and we're getting ready for Mandela. So that's moving along, and I'm happy about it. I've given you also a calendar of the meetings through next year, just so you can get an idea when we're meeting, and also conferences on the back. We'll also, and we'll be at the next meeting, we'll be approving that. Okay? And that's all I have for the written communications.
Okay. All right. Very good. Then we have, so is this including the director's report?
Yeah, I'm done.
We're good with all of it.
Oh,
okay.
The director's report, I do have a couple announcements. One, there were some owners who are awaiting their HAP checks this month, and it was not our system. It was actually the post office. Okay. We've used it to try and spin people into direct deposit, where we just wire them the money, and we don't have to mail it anymore. And I wish everyone would do that. Other housing authorities have required it, but we have a lot of mom-and-pops who don't trust that. So we're not doing that, but I sure would like to encourage anyone. And so if you hear from any owners like they got their check late, we delivered them correctly on time. They received them on time at the post office. It just didn't get out the door on time. And I'm not sure what they're doing on their end.
Our perfectly reliable post office has failed.
But my best answer to everybody in the world listening, go to direct deposit. You can trace it. We're going to open up new portals. It's called Rent Cafe, where the owners can log in and check every payment, and they can check every ledger. So it's going to make life a lot easier.
And I heard from one of our residents that, and I'm hoping this does it regularly, but we also sweep accounts for rents, right? Does it go the other way, too?
The tenants can log on, and I actually have an account in the same system, not with OHA, because my property owner uses it.
Because she had an issue where it wasn't swiped right, like twice, maybe even three
was
times,
it
where it took, how do I say this, the money was left in the account. It kind of, it was weird because it was like she, it was something. So I know that when we swipe and we clear folks' accounts, we don't usually have any issues with.
Well, everything goes to a lockbox if it's sent in, and it's done at the bank, not by us.
Not by us.
Yeah. So the bank scans them in. The ones that they cannot identify then go into a special batch, and the property managers have to go clear them.
Okay.
By name.
All right. Well, there was one resident that said, you know, my money was left in the account too long, and there was some discrepancy on whether I paid the rent or not. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know that we also sweep our tenants' accounts back to us. So it's interesting. And maybe that could have been an isolated incident.
Well, what will happen for the tenant accounts in the future is the future when we get to the cloud, which in the next couple of months.
Oh, good.
We'll roll out this Rent Cafe, where the tenants create a user ID and they go online and they can look at what they owe, and they can actually, you know,
look at
the ledger themselves and check it and all that.
Now, so that would be great.
It'll become a lot more apparent to everybody. The other thing I want to follow up on our discussion in August about voting sites, OHA has polling places at 3 of our developments: Peralta Villa, which is our largest, Palo Vista next to Lockwood, which would be our, you know, largest if you just count, if you put them together, and then Lion Creek Crossing, which has about 570 units. So we were able to get 3 polling places this year, and I'm happy to report.
Hey,
wonderful.
Very good. Also at Lockwood, and we are focusing at Lockwood, we are going to have a community meeting next Wednesday. Okay. We talked to the F2 group, the Lockwood group of residents, last Thursday, and I was not able to be there because I was in D.C., but they met with OHA staff and mostly OHA PD to talk about concerns in Lockwood. Okay. Regrettably, there's even been another shooting on Sunday afternoon at about 12:30. And so we want to meet with the residents on Wednesday just to talk about several issues. And some of it are there's complaints about parking, and the parking are that non-OHA folks are in our parking lots parking. There are people in the backyard and charging phones, I guess, and then playing in the playground. Are kids safe? And just those resident concerns. So we'll be out there on Wednesday night meeting with residents and hearing what they want to do with their development, because really we need their support to make anything happen. Additionally, on the 15th, we were out with a band, Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yes.
So we managed to have a mammogram band out there for the community, and awesome. OHAPD was there as well. It was FCP who set up the mammogram band, and OHAPD was there with their mobile companion, and they also had the pink patches that they were selling for Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Right. Did we take advantage of that? Were people willing to?
I don't know. I'd have to ask Lenita I'm not sure how many people actually signed up, because it was only a week ago, so I don't know.
That's difficult.
I think we haven't gotten the report, so look for it next month, and we'll get the total.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I was going to ask that.
And just lastly, I was at I was in D.C. last week at the CLAFA meeting, and also a mobility meeting that CLAFA hosted, and I will be. And it was an interesting visit, and I'm glad that I went. I made a couple progress. One related to our project-based rental contract administration, the CAHI business, and rebid, and met with some people about that. And I was also able to talk to the special assistant to the secretary about our FMR issue. So I think that we're hoping for some decent results on that. We'll see how it all plays out. And I will be, by the way, going back in December, which I regret because I don't want to go there in December, but I'm on, it's the first formal convening of the MTW group, and I'm on the steering committee that is being organized under CLAFA. So it'll
Thank
be all MTW over there. Yeah. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Wow.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that means we now have reports of commissions, committees.
I did a meeting.
Okay. Well, that makes that one easy. We have no meetings. So now we're going to
the CAHI. Can I mention the CAHI meeting that we had?
Reports of announcements.
Director.
Not appear.
Can I mention
the
CAHI?
Go for it, darling. We have a committee report.
We had an OP committee meeting last week, and we voted on getting two 401c3s, correct?
Oh, yeah.
One.
So that was not,
exciting.
That was actually, that was, you're talking about the OP actual board meeting.
Board meeting. We had an OP, or was it a committee? So I haven't had a committee meeting.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's 501c3.
But still, that was exciting. Just
well,
so you know.
That's very good.
That was that.
It was exciting, and I'm happy
to say
that a board meeting was actually exciting.
It was exciting.
It was. By the way, we did submit our 4%. By a week ago, by last Friday, I guess.
Right.
While I was in D.C., we got all submitted. So we are down the road.
Right.
And we have already received some stuff from the state making RAMP official.
Okay.
So it's happened very quickly. Congratulations to Real Estate Development for rescuing our poor senior sites that need work.
Very nice. Okay, so it is true that one item was left off the agenda. So if any commissioners have any announcements, you may throw them out.
Yes, I do have a couple of announcements. Actually, I have a report, if I may just mention that. Director, at the CAHI meeting that we had? What's that?
It's on there?
It's on top. We had it on the agenda.
What?
Yeah. The announcement's by commissioners, so you're fine.
Oh, okay, great. Mm. Okay, bear with me. I have a couple of announcements. So October 5th, we had the CAHI meeting, and we passed the procurement and facility bond. We got that passed, and I was reelected as the chair for CAHI. So thank you very much for your consideration in that. And then I have another comment I want to make on the smoking. Oh, my goodness. 2014, I had this encounter with smoking on my campus at Merritt. And just the encounter of vaping, it affected me, and I started a club on campus because I didn't want students or anyone coming on the campus to be affected by that. So, and I'm looking at what we're doing with smoking. It's kind of like a passion of mine right now because of what smoking does to you and what I've got a lot of training in that, working with Alameda County. And on September 26th, I attended the Alameda County staff meeting regarding smoking, where they talked about Oakland House Authority and what they're doing with it. So I was really thrilled to hear that, and I want to show you something. And the work that I'm doing with smoking on community colleges, through a grant with the American Cancer Society, I get students to share their artwork. One of our college students did this as a piece of art.
Wow, that's heavy duty.
What does that look like? It's a cigarette at the gun. And it says, I kill 400,000 a year. That's what smoking does. This is what a college student did, and a high school student. And I get emotional here because of what I know cigarettes do to you. And where's my other one? And we did an art contest with the high school that we have on campus at Merritt College. A high school student submitted this. Just look how many harmful components a single cigarette contains. Just one is enough to make you addicted. A high school student did this. So when I go out,
wow, that's amazing.
For smoking, for people not to smoke, and even for the cessation programs, I want to give it a visual effect. What does smoking do? It kills. And I'm so glad that the Secretary approved this, that we're going into our public housing properties to help our clients not smoke. So whatever we do in terms of cessation, I know we're working. I know we're working with Alameda County. And Liz, Liz Williams, Project Director with America's Non-Smokers Rights Foundation. We're working with her on that, with the county. I don't know if we're working with her, but I know Alameda County is. You are?
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you. One more question. In terms of our residents, I know we sent out a letter to them regarding the smoking, and have we gotten any challenges in that area?
Yes, we have. And actually, if you could look at the memo is in the packet, which will give you the three main, the site by site on how many people are actually non-compliant by not signing their lease. And there are a few handful here and there.
Okay.
The seniors have been very compliant, I would say. It's the family sites that haven't been as cooperative.
Okay.
But only a handful of people have not signed the new lease and are non-compliant.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
It and also tells you how many complaints we've gotten about smoking, both for and against, like there's not a place or you know, that they want to have a place they could designate smoking and why they don't want to be outside.
Okay.
And then then I think we've only gotten one or two complaints about smoking.
Complaints?
Now, keep in mind, it's only public housing, only
I
sites.
Yes, I understand that.
It's not the mixed finance, and it's not,
yes,
you know.
Yes, I understand that. Thank you very much.
Some of them are smoke-free, too, though.
Yeah.
I just would have felt better if they did all assisted housing or not, you know, or they did everybody, period, in the country or not, and not broken it out.
Okay, I have two more announcements. Please bear with me. Now, as you all know that I'm really passionate about helping the reentry population. I said reentry populations, people coming out of prison and jails. On October 9th, I attended the Alameda County Probation Department Community Corrections Partnership meeting. I learned a lot about new funding opportunities that they have and programs. And in speaking with the chief, I'm going to be a part of that committee. And I was really pleased that she asked me to serve on that. So I know, don't we have staff that's a part of this too, don't we? Do we have staff doing something in this area regarding not the moms program, but just the overall reentry work?
The reentry, we have participated in the past in the reentry group that because they were affiliated with Moms. We don't attend the meetings regularly anymore, though.
Okay.
But we get notices. We just can't attend them.
Okay. All right. Well, I was at the last meeting, and I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's very informative.
Yeah. And I want to thank Nita. I got my invitation for the 38th Annual Holiday Splendor. Thank you very much. Got the invitation on that.
You got yours too?
Great. Thank you. And then I have two more announcements, please. I know I have a lot, but it's just two more announcements, please. Okay, so in reading the report with our education initiative, I want to thank Anita for the work that we do in that area. I was reading that 100 of the students were honored for not missing any school.
That's amazing.
Oh my goodness. That I was so moved when I read that. And all the work that we're doing with the Education Initiative. And I close by saying this. Last year at one of the Oakland Unified School District meetings, I met the principal for Latitude High School, Helen Hsu, and she learned about all the stuff that we're doing with our Education Initiative and everything that we're doing to help our parents and our kids be in school. And so she told me, I've been following you. And I didn't know what she meant by that, but when I got her email letting me know that, she submitted my name to their 28 Change Makers project for the high school, where the ninth graders are going to be interviewing 28 people that they have selected as change makers for their community. Not that I see myself as that, but she nominated me because of the work she has been seeing that I do through education. And when I shared with her the education work I'm doing with the Smoking Initiative, she got really more moved. So on October 31st, I'm going to be representing Oakland Health Authority in an interview regarding the work we've been doing. Now, I was going to ask her some talking points, Anita, but in reading our report, you gave me a lot of it there. But I think as a follow-up, when I get back with Atlanta, I'd like to maybe talk with you so that, you know, in my communication, I'm on point and I have everything accurate. But close by saying this, as commissioner, resident commissioner, I am so grateful to be able to serve and that people see me as someone that makes a difference. And it's moving for me that these ninth graders, are going to be interviewing me and asking me questions about our education initiative, what we do, how we help our parents and their kids be in school. All of that means a lot to me. And so thank you. Thank you. I think I'm done. I'm sorry. I have one more question. And this is for our director of lease housing, Ms. Hassan. In the residents that we serve at the window, do we ever survey them? I was reading in that report and just wanted to know, do we ever survey them? Find out, you know, how they receive the service. Was it okay with them or anything of that nature?
Michelle Hassan, leased housing.
Yes.
Commissioner Hurd, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
In reading the report, it said that we served a certain number of residents at the window out
yes.
there. Do we ever survey them as to asking them what level of service they received or were
they
satisfied?
Currently, we don't have an active survey process.
Okay.
We did have one when we were at 1805, but we haven't reinstituted it.
Oh, we haven't. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that something we could talk about? Or?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. We have the framework for it.
We do. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. But thank you for your work. And reading that whole report, Anita, oh my goodness, all the stuff that we do for our residents, it is just so amazing, and I'm appreciative of the work all of you guys do for the Oakland Housing Authority. Thank you. I'm done now.
Okay, thank you, Marlene.
I just have one.
Okay.
Really short.
Tomorrow there's a press conference at Frank Ogawa Plaza at 12 o'clock. The United Nations will be releasing a report on housing. And we are mentioned in it because we have third world conditions in a country as rich as ours, meaning our people that live outside. So we are now, you know, mentioned in a report that should not include us. It's very significant because it's going to mean that we're going to hopefully make changes in our curbside communities. I'm hoping that we become kinder to them and create policies that will allow them to live in dignity even outside. Because in other countries, there are a lot of people that build their own housing and create a community on ground, and then the cities must honor that community and provide services like hygiene and services. They are called, I want to remember this, it's so important. It's left me. Formal settlements. They are called formal settlements, while here in America, we call them illegal encampments. So just making that change is really interesting. And what the United Nations has called us to do and charged us to do is to upgrade our encampments and honor them and do things differently. So I'd like to send it to you, Director, and if you could send it to everyone so they could take a look at it. You'll see this particular UN rapporteur went all over the world. And she said, and if, I presume you have the other article that she wrote about us, particularly that she's never seen such cruelty than she has ever seen against folks that live outside, than Oakland, specifically San Francisco. So I will send that out to the commissioners, if I could do it through your email address, and it's released tomorrow. I hope you guys take the time to read it.
It's big.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a motion to adjourn, closed session.
I second that motion.
Okay,
or do
well,
you
I can't,
need one first?
Yeah, I can't really make a motion.
Because it's like, I have one. I heard I have one. So I'll make the motion.
Okay, so we're going to just do like 5 minutes.
And then we'll back to closed session.
Thank you, Commissioner.
We want to try to be...
She doesn't have a second, sir. She doesn't have a second on the motion.
Who doesn't have a second?
Our secretary.
Oh, we have the motion. I think that's good enough.
Donna seconded.
Yeah. All right, because we don't vote on it, so we're good.
So a motion, not a second?
Yeah, you know, I actually, to be honest with you, I really don't understand, but nobody's be all about it, so it's okay.